Alan Kring Productions presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, academic lectures in business and economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 240, Section 4 for Spring Semester 2019. Lecture 16, delivered on March 27, 2019. The title of this lecture is Risk and Return.
Tonight, Risk and Return. Now, the first thing to talk about is risk. Risk is fairly easy to describe, maybe not to define, but to describe on a lightweight level. It gets a little more complicated, and we have to be able to put numbers to risk. And in order to put numbers to it, we have to have a reasonably sharp definition. To start with, we could say that risk is uncertainty of outcome. See, if you know what's going to happen next, there's no risk. But it's only when there is some uncertainty about an outcome that you are beginning to talk about that thing we call risk. But uncertainty can be described, or it can be have numbers put to it. Let me show you a quick, dirty little example of risk. Just a toss of a fair coin. Now, let's say that if the coin comes up heads, there's obviously a 50% chance that that could happen, and you will get a dollar. Tails, of course, there's a 50% chance of that. The probabilities are equal. That's a little bit of a special case, but one way or the other, if it comes up tails, you get nothing. So the expected payoff is going to be the weight of each of the outcomes times the outcome. So in this case, it would be 0.50 times a dollar plus 0.50 times nothing. So the expected payoff is going to be 50 cents. Now we talk about reaction, the human reaction to risk. We can have risk averse. We can have risk neutral and risk preferring, or risk loving, or risk attenuating. Now, a risk neutral investor would be willing to pay 50 cents to take this bet. A risk-averse investor or a risk-averse player or gambler would pay the expected payoff, no more, no less. Now, a risk-averse investor would pay less than the expected. And a risk-preferring would pay more than 50 cents to take this bet. Overall, markets are risk-averse. In other words, in order to induce someone in the market to take a risk, you must give them a better possible return. Let me say that again. the risk-averse market will require a higher expected payoff for that invest for the investors to take greater risk. You have to offer them more in order for them to play at a higher risk level. That's risk aversion. And we see that. That's how our markets work. That does not mean that there are not risk-preferring investors. As a matter of fact, in my derivatives class, there is a whole class of derivatives players. They are just crazy. They take risks that would scare the hell out of a normal person. In a given day, they could be up, or on one day, they could be down $2.8 million. The next day, they could be up $800,000. It's just up and down. You have to have real strong internal organs to handle that kind of stuff. And they'll do it. So there are risk-preferring investors. This is not saying there aren't. But overall, the market is made up, is driven by risk aversion. In order to induce investors to take a greater risk, you have to give them the expectation that they could get a better return, a higher return. That's what that means. However, risk has many different dimensions to it. Risk is not just a single thing. And we have to look at all the different kinds of risk, especially in different kinds of finance. We have to look at risk in different ways in order to understand how to price risk. I'm going to start with an example of risk as a function of time. Now, sir, I have asked you to be my demonstrator here, so please come up here. Now, what I'm going to have you do is shoot me with powder. Now, I want you to imagine that this dimension is time. We're close in time. Now, what I want you to do is just honk that thing at me. Fire. Not... Here!
Oh, I'm sorry.
Now, step back. Notice the blast pattern right here. It was supposed to be right here, but right here, okay? Now... Okay, let's get the powder up to the front. You're going to have to honk it this time. Fire! See the blast pattern? It's wider. Time, for God's sake, this is a serious class. Time allows for more possible outcomes. Do you see what happened? Boy, I'm going to have a hard time explaining this at the Steak and Shake tonight. Thank you. Yeah, if they could, they'd fire me, but they don't dare because they don't know how crazy I really am. I got it up in my nose. Okay. So time drives risk. Will you focus on the freaking lecture? So and that's an important thing, you see, because, you see, if we have a longer time of an investment, there's more possible outcomes that can happen. Interestingly, this is a physics principle, and it drives everything. Well, many, many things in the universe follow the same principle. So, for example, we see that a supernova, in a very short time after it happens, it's a small sphere. but as time goes on, more and more of it spreads out and can cause damage to planetary systems farther and farther away. So there are more possible outcomes that are negative, usually. I mean, if you're on another planet, you say, oh, there's a supernova. We see it in gas diffusion. So you push gas in fuel injectors. As the gasoline goes through the fuel injector, it sprays out and creates more and more of a spread as it fires farther and farther into the chamber. So this is not just finance. This is physics that drives this kind of a risk. And there are other types of risk, too, that we need to find ways to talk about those in mathematical terms. But sometimes we have risks that are, we know that there is a risk, but that risk is hard to explain in math. We can, but we do recognize that another demonstration is going to be required here, okay? This one, I brought in these. Now, these are my, what are these? Ah. This one's cool. Oh, and here's a cool one. He's got a... And this one. And then you got this really, these pretty ones. This one's flashing. Ha-ha. Okay. Okay, now. Come on, guys. Now, sir, as I told you, I'm going to use you for a demonstration. These are mini dragons. Attack! The frequency of the attacks was very high. Were you hurt? Sure, you're all right now. But what happens if suddenly, instead of a lot of mini dragons, the once in every century giant fly. Wait. Let me. Fire breathing dragon. Oh! Right here. Oh. Oh, God. Severity. This would have hurt. Nah. These don't. Much more frequent. Frequency was high, but severity was low. Here, frequency was low, but severity was high. So sometimes you have to look at risk in terms of how often it happens and what is the damage from it happening. In this part of the country, the Midwest, most people don't know this, but we have a fault line going through here, a fault line from hell. It's called the New Madrid Fault Line. Runs up not far from here. The last time it really broke along the line was in the early 1800s. The letters that were written from St. Louis area about this happening were like reading modern science fiction of an apocalypse. Buildings, just hundreds, thousands of buildings, fires, and the earthquakes kept happening over and over. Not just aftershocks, but major ones over 6 weeks. It was so bad, that occurrence was, that the people at the time wrote that the Mississippi River ran backwards. It didn't. The land lifted so violently that it threw the waters of the Mississippi back north, and then they came back south as a tsunami. They flooded the farmlands all along the Mississippi River, and then they killed many more people who were already hurt or injured or homeless from the earthquakes. But it happens only every few hundred years, 200 to 500 years. Frequency low, severity extremely high in a situation like that. And that makes for a type of risk that is more complicated to price. For example, interestingly enough, and I've been following this since I first saw it, there was a fellow who was dealt in reinsurance. He spoke to my finance club about 4 or 5 years ago. And what he said, he was showing the calculation for earthquake premiums. What's the risk of a really damaging earthquake in this part of the country? And he was showing that they were assigning a probability of this event happening. He showed the numbers for 1995 and from there. The numbers were at 0.005, in other words, 0.5% chance in a year, which means that the premiums would be fairly low. But interestingly, as every year went on, up to 2 years ago, it was the last time I saw it, that probability was edging upward, 0.005, 0.006, 0.0067. to last 1.0082. So each year that it doesn't happen, the next year is a higher probability, but it's still extremely small, so the earthquake premiums are still small, but every year the premiums are going up because that probability is nudging upward year over year. Why is that happening? Simply because, just like any other fault line, it's building pressure. And if that one snaps in the modern age, goodbye Chicago. Which, I mean, depending on how you feel about Chicago, you know, there are some restaurants I'll be sad to see go. But so that gives you an idea of risk in another thinking, a way of thinking about it. Frequency versus severity. Time as a driver of risk is one. Also, there are other factors too. Risk... You, madam, are a cluster B sociopath serial killer. Now, that's an issue in a relationship. You know, it certainly adds, you know, you're really fun at a mosh pit. I mean, a lot of people don't come out of it, and it gets real quiet, and everyone goes home real sad, but the ones who live. But, you see, that is individual risk. That is person-specific risk, just like company-specific risk. Tesla is an extraordinarily risky company because its boss is a nut, a crazy man. However, you put that risk of that you in a crowd, and your risk isn't nearly as important as it was before, because it is smoothed out by all the people who are not crazy or who are crazy the opposite way. They think they're superheroes, so when they see a serial killer, they save the day. So you see, as that would be a broader concept where risk is being mitigated by diversification of the population. You, sir, are going to have high blood pressure when you're 40. You're going to have diabetes when you're 45. You're going to need very large doses of Viagra when you are 50. But at the same time, you, sir, are highly, highly healthy. You're a great specimen of a man. You're built like a brick shipyard. My God. So you see, by putting both of you into the same health insurance pool, do you see how that smooths out? And also by putting young people with old people, the young people generally are healthier and the old people are sicker, and then they balance each other out. And then when those young people get old, their illnesses are balanced out by the people of the next generation. The illnesses that afflict one ethnicity of people are not the same illnesses that afflict another ethnicity of people, so they balance each other out that way. So there you go with that same diversification that makes part of the risk go away. And so arises, we begin to see that the risk that is really important is this underlying hum that really doesn't have a whole lot to do with the individual players, the individual people insured, the individual cities that are insured against earthquakes, the individual countries that are insured against nuclear accidents, the individual stocks that are in well-diversified portfolios. Once you get enough, that weird risk of individuals, serial killers, you know, people with diabetes and all that vanishes, and underneath comes the risk of the populations, of people, of cities, of countries, of stocks. That's the whole important point of not doing things like buying a single stock, because you're buying a lot of risk the markets say you don't need. We're not going to give you any reward. You shouldn't expect a reward for taking that kind of stupid risk, because you could have gotten rid of it. So no one's going to give you a pat on the back for taking that. That's why these TV shows that say, well, this fund manager made 25% return last year. It means nothing. What risk did he take to do that? He could have taken insane risks he didn't need to have gotten the same thing. So no one gets a reward from me for, and should not from you, just because you made a lot of money in the stock market. That's fine for you if you want to do that for yourself, but when you're trying to deal with with other people and be responsible for their investments, no, that's the kind of thing that you get fired for in a company that I'm involved in. So there's that. Whoops, didn't mean to do that. Well, I see, I'm okay. Now, the mathematics of this. It can get tedious and just a pain in the butt to do the math of these kinds of things. Fortunately, we have calculators, and more importantly, we have Excel. If you have your notebook, bring it out and run it. On Monday, definitely bring your notebook with you. I'm going to show you some more Mad Excel tricks. As I've told you before, we've got all this griping from these employers saying, well, they say they know Excel, but they really don't know anything past, you know, equals A1 plus B1 and all that. So we're doing a lot more, well, at least I am, right away, to get you more comfortable with Excel and some of the mad tricks that you can do with it. Is there some reason why that projector sucks? Oh, it's not on PC. Okay. So the next thing we would want to do is get a general idea of what expected value is. But I want to point this out first. We generally and you'll see this in the pictures, the graphs in the book and all that kind of stuff. We assume the data, if there's enough of it, it's got a normal distribution, that normal, the bell curve and all of that. And here's your expected value right here, the center point of the distribution and all that kind of stuff. And the spread of it we measure by the standard deviation. Now, a normal distribution, a standard normal, well, any normal, just by the nature of a normal distribution, about 67% of the data will fall within plus or minus one standard deviation of the average or the mean. About 67% will. That's what a normal is. It's just that's how it works. We also, from a normal, 95% of the data will fall between plus and minus two standard deviations, and 99% of the data will fall within plus and minus three standard deviations of the center. It's a nice, symmetric, pretty distribution, and the law of large numbers says most data falls into this nice, normal distribution. Unfortunately, that's not right. It's fine for everyday, day-to-day stuff. And I use the normal distribution for this class, for the next classes, all the advanced classes. But by the time I get you up there to the top, if that's where you want to go, you want to major in finance, you have to recognize that this isn't exactly right. Because you see, a normal distribution places an extraordinarily low probability on for stock returns on very large market swings. In other words, it is once in a century or two that you would have a massive crash of the market or a massive upswing of the market. And the normal says that that's what it shouldn't happen hardly ever. And yet it does. Since the 20th century, we've had at least five ridiculously large crashes of the market. That would be an extremely highly, highly unlikely event if stock returns are truly distributed normally. So we know that for everyday stuff, normal, we use it, we teach it, all that, but we recognize that's not the one that's really playing. There is, and you would have to take a high-level probability theory course, not statistics, probability theory, to learn that there's a doppelganger, a distribution that looks a lot like a normal, except that the tails are just fact. It has a name. It was discovered, created, sort of designed by a mathematician named Cauchy several centuries ago. The Cauchy distribution. You don't need to know that, but I will warn you. The Cauchy distribution does have a decent probability of very strong events way off the average. The Cauchy, we don't use it because it is a nasty distribution. The Cauchy doesn't even have a standard deviation. It is that weird. In technical terms, there is no second moment about the mean and all that good stuff, whatever. So realistically, in the real world, the probability of a major surge way up or a major crash way down is higher than the normal distribution would say. So we just recognize that. Day to day, we use a normal distribution, but that's probably not a good idea if you're doing extremely long-term planning. However, we do know that the Cauchy has a very strong pull back toward the center. Interestingly, that would explain something else that you'll see tonight. In other words, the Cauchy gives a very decent probability of otherwise very unlikely events, but it also has this odd property that after one of those, it tends to recover back towards the center. We'll see more about that in a little while. However, just to start this out, the basic. How do you find a weighted average expected return? Yeah.
Just out of curiosity, was that developed, the Cauchy, for financial purposes?
Oh, no. It was long before finance was even recognized. The Cauchy distribution, there was a time when probability theory was considered a dirty, dirty version of a part of math. And you wouldn't even write your name as the author of a study. The Cauchy was designed almost like, well, here's a cool thing. It looks like a normal, but it doesn't have a standard deviation. And it was almost no more than that at the time. And it was only later that we began to realize that there was real-life data that did this. It was sort of like there was a mathematician in the 1800s. He was the laughingstock of his time because he wrote the theoretical papers that gave the mathematics of knots. He did the mathematics of hundreds of knots. And everyone thought, this is the stupidest thing we've ever seen. It was only about 5 years ago when these biomedical researchers were looking at viruses. Viruses have this nasty thing. They'll go in and they'll put a cover over the DNA while they mess with it. And then when they're finished, the cover will come off, and you'd see the DNA all tangled up in weird knots. And they said, oh, this is the mathematics that crazy guy did. So this is how viruses work. They work by the mathematics of knot theory. So sometimes it's only decades or centuries after some stupid thing is done that we actually see why it's where it might be useful. But anyway, going on here, okay, let's do this. Suppose that you have a certain stock, return and probability, and I'll do... Okay, so we could have a return of -6% with a probability of 0.15, a return of +2% with a probability of 0.35, and an event of, let's say, 5% with a probability of 0.20, and a return of 9% with a probability of 30%. So the way we find the expected value of the return is simply to say that it would be -6% times 0.15 plus 2% times 0.35 plus 5% times 0.20 plus 9% times 0.30. Now, first I'm going to do this with the calculator, and then I'm going to show you a trick. Not a trick. Something that most people don't know about, an Excel thing. Okay, so the first thing that I would want to do here is just get my calculator up, my TI, and I would just do it as -6% times 0.15 plus 2% times 0.35 plus 5% times 0.20 plus 9% times 0.30. So the expected value of the return is 3.5%. Did I do that calculation right? Yeah, I guess I did. I might have made a mistake in there. Okay. Let me show you, start you out. I'm going to show you some mad Excel skills tonight. Some new ones and some I've done before, just to reinforce. Let's say... possible return is cell A1. Cell B1 is probability. And I'll put those numbers in there now. The -6%, the 2%, the 5%, and the 9%. And over here on the next column, I'll put the associated probabilities, 0.15 down 0.35 down 0.20 down and 0.30. Now, the way a lot of people would do this is they would take this times this, put it there, plus this times this, put it there, this times this, put it there, this times this, put it there, and then take the sum of those. There's another way you can do it that's a lot easier. Equals sum product. You give it the first array from A2 down to A5, comma, then you give it the second array from B2 down to B5. Well, spank me. Believe me, that's a lot faster to do than if you had a lot of data. Some product takes a pair. Now, the arrays, of course, have to be exactly the same length. And that's what those are called. In math, those are called vectors. In Excel, they're called arrays. And that is such a nice way to do, especially if you've got a huge amount of data, to do your sum product and get your weighted average. And you can do this with any kind of weighted average, the sum product. So that's a nice little trick to show you, especially for if you've got data with different weights in the study and all that. It's really, really nice to have that when you've got a portfolio and you've got different amounts of value for different stocks in the portfolio. So each one has its own weight in the portfolio to do the sum product to get the expected return. And also you can do that with the betas too, different stocks with different betas. The sum product is just outstanding for that. However, we have to talk about some other things now too. Standard deviation is how our classic measure of spread. It's our first measure of risk. The wider the distribution, the more possible outcomes, and therefore by our definition of risk, the greater the risk. So a big standard deviation means that there's more risk in that data than there is with a small standard deviation. However, in and of itself, that's not really the best measure of risk. One that we'll get to, and I will probably wait until Monday to do that one, is beta. But there's one along the way. There are a couple along the way which are more, shall I say, appropriate. You see, if I've got data, and all of the data is huge numbers, and I've got another set of data where the data are all small numbers, the big number data is going to have, by the nature of the size, the scale, a huge standard deviation compared to the data that had small numbers. That does not tell us anything about the relative risk of the two data groups. We would like to have something that is standardized so that, for example, if I see the cash flows of a multi-million dollar corporation over a period of 10 years, and I see the cash flows of a small corporation, $100,000, $400,000, $800,000 over those same 10 years, I would like a way to compare their volatilities with each other. The standard deviation won't do that, but I'm going to show you a place where it can. But the first thing I'm going to do is take you back to something that I showed you once before, and I'm hoping that the program here at ISU is a little bit better in these classrooms, is a little more robust. But let's look at the expected value and the standard deviation, and a couple of other measures of risk of stock market data. Now, in order to do this, I need a good long vector of stock returns by year. And I'm pretty sure I showed you this before, but we are going to say goodbye to the calculator, and the next thing we're going to do is go here in the web browser to onestock1.com. To help, where is my historical stock returns? Okay. I'm on the front page instead of the investing in stock selection. Let me do something real quick here. Let me go to Google and get to the page here that I want to. Historical stock market returns see if I can get to one and one, the page I want. OneStockOne.com. Come on. I want one stock. There it is. I couldn't find it on their front page. Okay. Now, the nice thing here is that you can get years of annual stock returns. And I want to take three to make some principles, interesting principles. Let's start with the Dow Jones Industrial Average. Now, it would be a pretty big pain in the butt to take each of these numbers and key it into Excel. I mean, this is one of the things that they want you to know how to do. When these companies are saying to us, this is what we want out of our students, one of the first things that comes out of their mouths is big data. Do they know how to handle big data? Do they know how to do captures of big data? Do they know how to do analytics of big data? They're harping on us to the point where now it's about getting to the point, we're going to have a meeting on Friday where we're going to formalize how to get this into the curriculum. I'm just doing it. You're welcome. Anyway, watch. It's actually pretty cool. Watch. Now, first we're going to go to data. And I'm going to... Wait. Let me do something. I am going to copy the URL, the web address, of this data set right here. And I'm going to just click on the address bar and hit Control-C. When you get into corporate use of Excel, you use the mouse less. You will use keyboard commands more. It's just the way it is. So instead of right-click and copy, you just do Control-C. Now it's in the clipboard. Now I'm going to go here to Excel. I'm going to say, all right, I want you to get some external data from the web. Now up here in the address bar, this is where I'm going to put Control-V. Whoops. Control-V. And then I'm going to say go. Now it's going to give me a scripting error. If it gives you scripting errors, just say yes. It used to be when I did this on these, they had so many firewalls, I was getting scripting error, scripting error, scripting error. I shouldn't get too many this time. Go. My ass. Control-C. Let's try that again. Oh, I see. I wrote in the Control-V. Go. See, scripting error, just say yes. It should be the only one. Yeah, there we go. Now, Excel is going to look for any place that it sees a table. The problem is that a lot of web design is very bad because it uses tables for everything, the menu bar, everything. And so you'll run into sites where there are lots of these little yellow arrows where Excel is seeing a table. Now, in this one, it has pretty much just this one. This is what we want. See it? It's got little yellow arrow box pointing to the one we want. Just click on it and say import. It says, do you want us to start in cell A1? Yes, please. Okie dokie. Well, spank me. Look at that. All that data right there. I mean, you imagine this. If you're using Federal Reserve data for interest rates from day to day, week to week, for 50 years, I mean, this is just like unbelievable that you can just drop it in. That's what they mean by handling big data. Go. I can make it. That's a macro, and I can make it do that. And if you took me for the next level of course, I will show you how to write a nice little macro so that every time you open the spreadsheet, it just automatically updates the data. I can even make it so that it says yes to the scripting error, so that I know that every time I open it up, I've got my fresh data in there. That's what I have to do. For example, with portfolios that I do for the 240 class, every groups have to make a portfolio. So what I do is I show them, so, okay, every time you open your Excel sheet to look at your portfolio, it updates the stock prices, updates your return on your portfolio and everything like that. Just automatically it goes to the web, finds the prices, and brings them back in. Now, the next thing I'm going to do, back in the day, and we who are the geeks of the old days still use the term parsing. We parse the data. Now they just say, well, you clean up the data. In other words, you get rid of what you don't want. And in this case, I'm not going to want columns B, C, or D. All I want is the year against the percent gain or loss. So I will say, delete those columns right there. But then I'm going to say, now wait a minute. I'm sorry, I don't want to do that. I don't need that data. And you're going to say, well, if you don't need it, why are you keeping it, fat boy? Because I'm going to do some magic. Now, the first thing I'm going to do is rename this sheet the Dow. Now, I'm going to make two more sheets. One for the S&P 500. And then I'm going to make a sheet for the NASDAQ. And you say, okay, well, what's going on here? So now before I do anything else, I'm going to bring in the data vector for the Standard & Poor's 500. I'm going to, again, click on the address bar, hit Control-C, and then I'm going to go in on the second worksheet and say, data, get external data from the web, and this time I'm doing this one, go. Scripting error, yes. And here it is. Click on the data table that we want on that little yellow arrow, import. Make sure you put it in exactly the same position that you did the first data. Okay, this is nice. Okay, so now I'm going to go over and get the NASDAQ. And first thing is I'll go back and fetch the NASDAQ. By the way, this one stock one is just awesome because it has all of these data sets for everything from markets around the world to stocks and everything, but returns for years and years. Control C. And so now I'm going to go back here and I'm going to put it up here and I'm going to say get external data from the web and I'm going to hit Control V, go. Scripting error, then click on the yellow arrow for the data table, import, same place. Okay, so now I'm going to go back over here to this Dow. And I'm going to do first parse, and I'm going to then do the expected value, the standard deviation, and a couple more. But before I do that, I'm going to say, all right, I'm going to hold down the control key. I'm going to click on these two other worksheets. You'll see why in a minute. I'm still on the Dow. First thing I'm going to do is I'm going to get rid of all that data that I didn't want, those three columns, B, C, and D, delete those. Now the next thing I'm going to do is go down here to the bottom. Okay. Average return is in 46. Then the standard deviation, A47. And then a couple of oddballs. One called the coefficient of variation, and then another one called the Fisher ratio. Widen that column so it does these, and then I'll left justify them. So the first one equals average, and I stream the data vector clear down to there. Now, before I close the parentheses, actually, I don't need to close the parentheses. Don't waste your time. I'm going to hit F4. That makes that an absolute reference. And you'll see why I'm going to do that in just a second. Enter. So the Dow's average return since 1975 was 9.69%. Now, the next thing I'm going to do is I'm going to go back to B46, to that average. I'm going to grab its little handle and pull it down to standard deviation. I'm going to say, well, why did you do that? All you did was copy the average. Yes, but I also don't have to go and highlight the data anymore. All I have to do is write STDEV. You see, I save myself typing, and I save myself the possibility of an error in finding the right cells. Now, a caution here. STDEV finds you the sample standard deviation. STDEV.P would find you the population. If your data is all of the data that could possibly exist, you want the population standard deviation. If all you have is a sample, then you want the sample standard deviation, STDEV. So in other words, if I were interested in the average weight of college men, and I want to know the dispersion of the data, the spread, I would weigh every guy in this class. And that would be a sample of all of them, so I'd use STDEV. But if I weighed every male on every college campus and got the data, then I would use the population standard deviation. Almost always you're going to use the standard deviation of the sample, which is actually this messy formula divided by n minus 1. If it's population, it's divided by n, the number of them itself. Okay, so we've got that. So now, the CV and the Fisher, I'm going to have to make sure these don't, it'll try to do these as percents, and I'm going to keep it from doing that by saying these are just numbers rounded to two decimal places. Okay, so the next thing you're going to do is CV. You see, the coefficient of variation takes the standard deviation and divides it by the average. So in other words, this scales the size of the dispersion by where the center of the dispersion is, so that the CV allows me to compare the risk of very large data with the risk of data that has smaller numbers. So in this way, some stock returns are very high because it's risky stocks. Some stock returns are very low because they're safe stocks. So in other words, that very high returns would have big standard deviation because the numbers are big. In this way, I get everything down so that it is in these pure units of a coefficient of variation. Now, I'm not going to do the Fisher ratio because I'd have to have the expected return to the market portfolio and all that. So I'm not going to do that one. Matter of fact, I'll just delete that one. So now we have these three nice pieces of data. And we'll put a nice little thing around this, nice thick border. Okay, isn't that cool? And now you're saying, oh, God, we have to do this two more times for the Standard Poor's 500 and the NASDAQ? No, you don't. Oh, looky. It did the same thing to those. Because I highlighted them all, what it did to one, it did to the others at the same time. Even though you didn't see it doing it, it did it to the others. So in other words, if you're going to do something to a whole series of worksheets, just highlight all of them. And then what you do to one will be done to all of them. Heck, I could even watch this. Let me go back up here to the Dow, and just hold down the control key. insert, and I'll say, make it bold, merge and center it. Okay, so now that's the DAO. Oh, look, it did it to the other ones as well. Isn't that interesting? So there's some, a couple of new mad skills you've got from tonight. Now, the next thing that we might be interested in here is now let's look at what the data actually tells us. Okay, the DAO. Over a period from 75, if you bought the Dow 30 industrial portfolio in 1975 and you held it for all these years and sold it at the end of 2018, your annualized return would have been 9.69%. That would have included huge drops, crashes in the market, big upswings. Altogether, if you had just bought and held, you would have had a 9.69% return on the biggest, safest companies. If you had done that with the Standard & Poor's 500, just bought and held from 1975, and sold at the end of last year, you would have had an annualized return of 9.75%. And if you had done that with the NASDAQ, not lost your cool, not crapped your pants when the markets crashed and all that, just held, bought and held, you would have been up 14.01%. That's the power of buy and hold. Now let's look at something interesting. Notice that if you look at the CVs, not at the standard deviation, just look at the CVs. The NASDAQ has a CV of 1.74. The Standard & Poor's has a CV of 1.61, lower risk. And the Dow has a CV of 1.55, even lower risk. And surprise, surprise, the highest risk, the highest return. The second highest risk, the second highest return. The third highest volatility, the third highest return. Coincidence? I think not. The greater the risk, the greater the expected return. It is a rock solid principle. Isn't that's kind of interesting. Now, also notice something else interesting. Notice that the Dow, that the NASDAQ has a much higher return over those years. What is 75, 25, 35, 43 years, I think. About 43 years. Yeah, 43 years. Over those 43 years, the Dow had a considerably higher return than the S&P and the Dow. Now, notice that the S&P really isn't that much better than the Dow. Basically, because the S&P has the Dow in it, and those Dow stocks are huge, they're very much significant to the overall S&P 500. So these two are highly correlated, and not surprisingly, their CVs are close to each other, and their expected returns, their returns are fairly close to each other. Now for something interesting. We preach the gospel of buy and hold, which drives us crazy because they're constantly in the news media, the financial networks. Well, buy this stock today, sell that stock tomorrow. Buy here, sell there. Make those commissions bigger for the people who advertise on our programs. And it infects some of our faculty. I'm not too far down the hall. I heard this one adjunct saying, I want to make sure, he was telling his TA, make sure that they do at least 30 trades a day. And if they do less than that, then drop their grade. Are you nuts? Are you on crack? Well, you can't be. You're old. that's irresponsible. Well, let me show you. Okay, let's say that you had put $1,000 into the NASDAQ on January 1, 1975. So we'll put $1,000 into the NASDAQ times 1 plus the annualized rate of the annual rate of return over that period. Now we raise that to the number of years. So in other words, this will be what that $1,000 is worth when you pull it out if you put in $1,000 on December the 31st of 2018. And you put in the $1,000 on January the 1st, 1975. $280,728. That's the power of compounding and not losing your cool. The whole idea in any situation, I'm talking about combat, corporate competition, stock markets, is to not be a victim of chaos. You be the one who creates it for everyone else to scream about while you just buy and hold. That's why I'm more than happy to tell people buy and sell and buy and sell. And oh God, everything's going to go to hell. It's the apocalypse and all that. Because then I can just sit there and watch them destroy themselves while I am the one who comes out with $1,000 that turned in when I started investing, that turns into $280,000 when I'm ready to retire. Every $1,000. So if you did this with $5,000, you'd have over $1 million. You do this with $10,000, you'd have a couple of $1 million. And that would be besides whatever you did with other things, your money with pension plans and all that. Buy and hold. Listen to your preacher here. Buy and hold. That's all I have for you tonight. Go home.